Welcome to the Ortho Joe Podcast, a joint production of the Journal of Bone and Joint Surgery and Ortho Evidence. Join hosts Mohit Bhandari and Mark Swankowski as they discuss current topics and publications in the world of orthopedics and beyond.
Well, good morning, Mark. How are you?
I am fine, Mo. It's extremely cold in our part of the world. And as you're sending this Canadian air our way, which always creates a lot of bundling up and car problems, et cetera. So, but we're well.
And that's good. I will give you the caveat that during my fellowship years, 2003, 2004 in Minnesota, my car made noises that I've never heard in the winter. Our winters do not make cars make the noises that my car made. But that being said, it could have been my car. It had nothing to do with the weather, I'm sure. But
we should clarify for the listening audience that we don't blame Ontario. We blame Alberta. They call them Alberta Clippers in our part of the world. So.
Very good. Well, I appreciate that. So today is, I think we're going to hit a bunch of topics today with our very special guest. And before I introduce her, I think that, you know, we're seeing in many ways a new generation of ways in which we connect and communicate and the ways in which we share research in general, you know, with our community. And I think that's just because the generations are different. And if you want to connect with people, you're going to have to find commonalities to do so. And no better a person than our guest today, Dr. Neil Fardagan, who is the chief of trauma at the Core Institute, also an associate professor at the University of Arizona. And I suspect many of you who are listening in today or watching us today have heard of her work. And if you haven't, you're about to get a pretty good whirlwind tour of the things that have made her particularly special. Welcome, Niloufar. How are you?
Well, thank you very much. That was an amazing introduction. Thank you. I appreciate it.
Listen, normally when I get introduced, I think it's only going to go down from whatever they've said about me. But from you, I think it can't go down. I think it's only going to get better and better. So let me start off, if I could, about something that has struck me. And to me, it seems relatively quickly how quickly you've been able to connect with a global audience on social media. And I'll use the word social media broadly, as I know you're active on LinkedIn and you're active on Instagram and a number of other places. But maybe you could just speak briefly about why you got involved in this. And I guess what your experience has been, because you've grown it relatively quickly.
Yeah, thank you for that. You know, I didn't really use social media up until last year. So, I mean, I did Instagram, but just friends, so we can keep track of each other's kids as they grow up. And that was kind of it. I didn't really want to get into the whole social media thing. I actually went to an orthopedic meeting. It was a value-based meeting with orthopedics and peri-op staff. And one of the talks they had was on social media. And essentially, the gist of this hour talk was, if you're not on social media, you don't exist. And which I felt very offended because I thought, well, I do exist. I'm here. But the message was, if people don't hear you and if you're not out there, then essentially, you know, you don't exist. And the speaker kind of at the end said, you know, you should all go just try it out. Just, you know, go out there. Get some discussion going and, you know, test the waters. And as part of trying something new, I thought, okay, why don't I give this a chance? And they kept talking about LinkedIn being the most common place that professionals and physicians, that's the most widely used social media platform. So I kind of started with LinkedIn. I had an interesting case, a complex elbow fracture, distal humerus fracture that came to me for second opinion. Someone fixed it. It fell apart, and there was a lot of teaching points in that case that I thought, you know, this would be really interesting. I felt very sorry for this lady that had this happen just because of the easy misses that were very preventable. So I posted that case about, hey, you know, I had this case. This is things we should avoid. Not really knowing what to expect from it, to be honest, but that kind of got things started, and I kind of snowballed from there. And that's kind of how things started, and it took off from there.
Well, I have a question for both of you, because you both have a very clear and well done presence in social media, and really well thought out. And what can you tell the audience about how you go about approaching which platforms, what kind of stuff to post? How detailed do you make a posting? How can you advise somebody who wants to exist, as you said, with putting their toe in the water, not making mistakes that are actually going to hurt their reputation?
I might add to yours, Niloufar, like you found a unique way to get engagement, right? So it's one thing to have people, you know, look at something you've done and quietly, you know, passively look at it, but not really engage. Was it a deliberate decision of yours to go to cases, and what prompted that over other ways in which you could tell and communicate with your audience, so to speak?
I don't know, to be honest. I mean, I don't really, you know, some people go out there and they have messages and political stuff or advice about life. I didn't really, I have cases. I see a lot of interesting cases, and I love teaching and working with residents. We have morning rounds every day. And I think just part of my own training too, when I was a resident, we had our morning rounds. It was very rigorous in a way that, what are the main teaching points? What do you want to take out of this case? What points do you want to hit if you're on your oral exam? These are the main points you want to focus on and you don't want to miss. So that way of thinking about a case has kind of been ingrained in my head. So when I have any case, it's kind of, where can this go wrong? How can you prevent it? What's plan B? What things are you going to try to avoid? And that's kind of how I approach a case. And that's how I think.
Is there anything surprise you though, like about like what's happened in terms of, you know, you'll get comments, you'll have a general idea. Was there just something about like the breadth, parts of the world that you were engaging that you didn't know about? You go to a meeting and suddenly people say, oh my gosh, I follow you and I know about you. Like, what surprised you about all this?
Yeah, you know, all of it. Because like I said, I really had no expectations whatsoever. What I've been surprised with is just the number of people out there doing what we do, right? I mean, I used to joke, I grew up in the Middle East and I didn't know there were so many orthopedic surgeons in the Middle East. It's just like thousands and thousands and thousands of them. And it's so interesting to be able to connect and communicate with people from all parts of the world and just to learn from them in terms of what they do and what works in their hands. And maybe it's not necessarily something we do here and we've been taught here, but just because we don't do it doesn't necessarily mean it's wrong or it won't work. I think what I've learned mainly is just because that's not something you would do doesn't mean you should crap on it when someone else does, because maybe that's something valid that you just haven't tried. So I've definitely learned to be more open-minded into other experiences and other ways to approach things. And also not to be too critical, right? It's so easy to, after the fact, say, hey, you should have done this, that, and the other, but you weren't really there. You don't understand the complex nature of what was going on with a patient and other factors that may have been involved. There's also a lot of resource issues, especially, you know, in the third world. So it's so easy for me to say, hey, just retrograde, nail it, and move on. Well, they don't have that in a lot of parts of the world. So you have to try to be able to come up with other ways to treat injuries.
Well, I want to go back to, again, both of you being very, very good at this work. And for those people who are in academia, you know, the traditional pathways, you write papers, you try to get grants and you do good research and try to build a curriculum vitae that will get you promoted in an academic environment. And it strikes me that this kind of work takes as much time as being engaged in, let's just say, retrospective cohort series construction. It seems to me, I would also add a footnote that I co-chair our promotion and tenure committee at our medical school. And as I see younger faculty coming through, that there's a whole shift in the way this type of activity is being valued in terms of assembling curriculum and your presence on social media, et cetera. I just wonder what your thoughts are in terms of how it does detract in a way from the time you spend doing traditional types of research, and what's the advantage, disadvantage, and maybe how that's changing. The two of you are in two different phases of your careers, but it might be helpful to the audience to have both of you comment on that. this takes time, I guess, is my point.
Yeah, maybe I'll jump in first, Niloufar, and curious to hear your thoughts on the same issue. The thing that I've become eminently aware of, Mark and Niloufar, is there's multiple ways in which you can make an impact. And, you know, the traditional, I'll say the word traditional, ideals of saying, well, I will make an impact through peer review publication, and I will try to get grants, and I will present my work at meetings, still superbly important. And, you know, I don't think I would minimize it in any way. But I would say to you that you're able to connect, depending on how you decide to do so, in a different way. So for me personally, the question I used to always get is, they say, well, like, your trainees always see you doing stuff that is unrelated to work, and, you know, or whatever it may be. And they would say, you know, it would be helpful if other people knew that you don't just live, eat, and breathe research, because that's the perception about you. And so I made it a point to actually become, if this is maybe a cliche, but more human in the context of, you know, I'm like everybody else, and I do the same things that everyone else tries to do. I have the same failures, I have the same stresses, and I try to make it that. So I've been very deliberate in really not making it about too much about the specifics of any research I'm doing or that, because I think people can read that. And I've been a bit more deliberate around just sharing the ups and downs or whatever that may be. And I'll tell you, Niloufar, I don't get anywhere near, I believe, the you know, people wanting to chime in, because the stuff they have to chime in about becomes personal. And, you know, I get it. People don't want to hear about, like, you know, there's all kinds of barriers to why someone might communicate issues. But I will tell you that there is 10 times more people that see your stuff that will never interact with you, but are aware of it. The number of times I've traveled to places and people have said, oh, I really appreciate your posts. And I said, great. And I go, I'm really about, for me anyway, that I'm just happy that I get, it's almost like a cathartic experience when you write about something, I find. And it's a creative writing for me. So I'll stop there. But for me, it's not scientific writing. It's more creative writing. And I think that's why I like it.
I think, you know, the social media stuff is fun, and it's a great way to engage and put yourself out there. But really, I don't think it replaces any of the original research, randomized control trials, good clinical research. So there's a lot of people out there on social media giving their opinion, but a single fact is worth 1,000 opinions, right? So just because you have a voice and you use it loudly doesn't necessarily mean maybe you're giving the right message. I always try, when I talk about a case or when people ask, to put some evidence behind what I'm saying. I think there's a lot of people saying, well, I would do it this way, or I would never do this, I would never do that. Well, that's maybe not the right thing you want to put out there. I always try to say, well, the literature says this. We don't really know the right answer. This is controversial. Maybe it is, fix it this way or that way or the other way. But I don't think any of this really replaces it. I think what it helps it with is knowledge transfer and getting the message out. So it's great to have a message with good science behind it, and then using social media to get the message out there. That's where I think they kind of come together.
And I guess maybe to add to this, so beyond the issue of social media, you've taken on a number of other, I think, really important roles, Niloufar, around leadership in general. Can you speak a little bit about, you know, sort of your motivation for that? And I'm speaking specifically about sort of the women leaders and the women leadership groups within orthopedics. And I've seen, like, that number just increasing appropriately so. And I'm wondering, you know, what your plans are, or what your vision is for that work.
I am very passionate about women in orthopedics, because I am a woman and I'm an orthopedic surgeon. And you know, I grew up in Iran, which is a very male-dominated society, right, where women don't necessarily have the same rights and freedoms. And I came to North America, where I basically have all the freedoms and same rights. So I lived in a place where I wasn't an equal. And within orthopedics, sometimes it's hard because we are a minority. And as a minority, you don't necessarily have the same voice. So 7% of orthopedic surgeons are women at the AAOS, at the Academy. I think the numbers, you know, it's definitely under 10% within Canada as well. I would love that number to increase. And it bugs me tremendously when I still have young medical students coming to me and saying, oh, well, I was interested in orthopedics, but somebody told me I can't have kids or I can't have a family or I can't, you know, work-life balance. So one of my passions is talking to medical students or young women saying, you know, the issues we deal with as orthopedic surgeons aren't anything new. I mean, any high-powered woman in any high-powered job goes through the same thing, right? You could be a lawyer and still have issues with childcare and work-life balance. It's not necessarily orthopedics. I think orthopedics just traditionally has this very macho image of this old boys club, and it makes people kind of stay away saying, well, those aren't my people. I'm going to potentially, you know, go to plastics or general surgery or other surgical specialties to see that where I see myself. I've been involved with several meetings, just women in orthopedic meetings, trying to talk about issues that affect women in orthopedics, like breast cancer or increased risk of breast cancer. Fertility is an issue. Women are delaying having kids for longer, just in all of society, and especially orthopedics with the training we have, higher risk of miscarriage, just the culture of, you know, the instruments don't necessarily fit. Or how do you deal with being a woman in this culture that's designed really for a man, but we also have to coexist in it? And it's nothing against the men. It's just, you know, it's nice to try to find a spot for everyone.
Well, I want to thank you for this very important work that I'm sure you're going to spend your entire career working on this. It's not going to change overnight for sure. And so thank you for that. But so you mentioned orthopedic surgery having this macho, I guess, image, but you've chosen as a subspecialty perhaps the most macho of the macho. And how did you come about the choice of orthopedic traumatology?
You know what? I didn't even know what orthopedics was until second year medical school. So I knew I wanted to do surgery, and I tried cardiac and various other things. And it wasn't until second year when we had our orthopedic or our MSK block, and we had Dr. Pat from Ottawa, who's a trauma surgeon, come and give us a talk. And his talk was basically just PowerPoints of mangled limbs and how he put them together, just before and after. And I thought, this is awesome. Like, this is a specialty. That's what I want to do. So that's how orthopedics for me started with orthopedic trauma. And it kind of stayed throughout residency. When I went for my residency interview in Calgary with Dr. Buckley, in the interview room, I said, hey, Dr. Buckley, I want to be a trauma surgeon like you. And he literally laughed at me saying, what do you know about orthopedic trauma? You don't know what you're talking about. I said, no, I really do. So that's kind of how it started. And I think orthopedic trauma is awesome. I tell the girls, like, you know, it's diverse. You get to see something new every day. No case is the same. I mean, you know, even an ankle simple fracture can still humble you, you know, if you get too cocky. And it's just a breadth of variety and a lot of unknowns. On the same token, if you don't like variety and you kind of like things always the same, then maybe it's not for you.
And maybe I'll end on a couple on this theme of questions, Niloufar, because I think we're trying to cover as much as we can, because you've got so many diverse interests. But beyond orthopedic trauma, you've also taken a pretty serious role in running trials and promoting, you know, high quality evidence. And, you know, outside of, you know, why you got into doing randomized trials, I mean, I have to believe that the Canadian ecosystem was a good one for you to have, you know, kind of fundamentally sort of, you know, trained in and understood. But when you think about some of the impact of the work you've done, do you continue to believe that the randomized trial work, let's say, for example, in the work you've done on tibial fractures and weight bearing, the work you've done on more recently, like that continues to have, you know, papers coming out on the chest wall fixation work. Like, do you continue to believe that the randomized trial is the most appropriate design to give you the best evidence you need? Or are you evolving now to other designs as well? Or other areas within, you know, the approaches to getting questions answered?
I'm still a believer that randomized controlled trial is the definitive way that you can answer the question. Maybe not the, you know, hip arthritis surgery versus not that you guys were talking about last time. But I think, again, it's a fact, right? So you can have a lower quality study, but the more lower quality it is, it becomes more of an opinion as opposed to a fact. So I think a randomized controlled trial gives you more, a definitive way to answer something as long as it's done right. But not everything lends itself to a randomized trial. And you're right. To be honest, it was a lot easier in Canada. And I got into it just because that was our training. I trained at a place where every person who came in the fracture clinic or through the ER was considered for a trial that was going on at the same time through the Canadian Orthopedic Trauma Society. We had so many trials going on. And I thought that was normal. I mean, it was great. And I thought, this is what I want to do for the rest of my life. Unfortunately, now, certainly in the US, it's so much harder to do randomized controlled trials just for a variety of reasons. I would love to recreate that culture that we had where any patient that comes in is considered for a trial because you have a lot going on. And I think it can really help change practice. Like the ankle weight bearing one we did, I was a resident and it just seemed like a very simple idea in terms of randomizing patients to weight bear 2 weeks versus 6 weeks after ankle fracture. But up until then, a lot of people did it. There was no real, science or good evidence behind it until we did that. And now I can go out and preach it saying, hey, well, we did this study. So now you have to believe me. It's not just that this is the way I do it, but there's some science behind it. So I think that's where it becomes helpful.
Well, that's great. I'm going to give Mark the last word here, but this has been great.
Well, it's been great chatting with you, and you've got a lot of areas and a very busy professional and private life that you're devoting your attention to. And we're grateful that our specialty has energetic, talented young people like you who are putting all this work in. And I guess I will leave with a question that may be a bit difficult, but where do you see yourself a decade from now in terms of your career?
That's a hard one.
Sorry.
That's okay. I mean, where I would love to see myself is in a leadership position. And I definitely would like to have a research role as well. So I'm still in my head. I still envision being in a place where it's a collaborative work to do multi-center clinical trials. And I can have a strong presence in the research world as well as clinical practice. I love operating, but I also love being out there and teaching and, doing research and that kind of thing. So I definitely see myself in a place that lends itself to being able to do both of those.
Well, I think we're both confident that you're going to pull that off. we'll look forward to seeing where you land a decade from now. But thank you for spending the time with us on Ortho Joe, and thank you for everything you're doing for your patients in the greater community of orthopedic surgeons. So thanks and have a great day.
Thank you so much for the opportunity to meet and talk with you both. This has been fantastic. Thank you.
That's great. Yeah. Take care. Have a great day.
Yeah. Bye.
Bye.